Do not let your hearts be troubled or afraid. Dear brothers and sisters, the Holy Spirit is with you.
Searches for his living soul, searches places that he don't wanna go, looks for love and for hope. He finds a world that's abandoned them both. Yeah, yeah. All the lies tell us just to set you free. What we need is that love, the love that comforts from heaven above.
Hi, I'm Kathleen McCarthy, and you're listening to What the World Needs Now, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. I invite you to join me in this hour of God's healing power. Call and join us in conversation and prayer. Remember, what the world needs now is God, and God is love. Well, welcome once again to What the World Needs Now. You are listening to Kathleen McCarthy, and I am blessed and humbled every day of my life to come across these airwaves. I praise and thank God for the gift of communications through the media, and particularly Catholic radio. And we're blessed today, as I told you yesterday, we're going to have a wonderful guest on today who's going to tell us about a wonderful young woman who made her mark in the world. Even though her life was ended early due to illness, cancer, she has gifted the world with so much. She taught, she danced, she sang. She was a woman filled with great joy. And with that, I'm talking about Sister Thea Bowman. Sister was a Franciscan sister of Perpetual Adoration. And I have with us on the air today, not in the studio, but on the phone, Sister Charlene Smith. And so Sister Charlene knew Thea, was a friend of Thea's, and she tells some cute stories in the book about Thea. The one I loved her particularly, when she thought she was a reader brought in by the sisters from the outside to do their reading, and it was kind of cute. So once again, Sister Charlene Smith, also a Franciscan sister of Perpetual Adoration, welcome to What the World Needs Now.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Got a lot of static on the line today. I don't know why.
Well, maybe we'll go away. We'll fix it up. Maybe.
There you go. Must be
otherwise
a powerful.
I could call you back if it gets too bad.
I feel it's going to be a powerful storyline. So, for our viewers today, she was an amazing, just riveting presence, wasn't she, Sister?
She certainly was, and I'd like to start out by just reading a couple of paragraphs from the introduction to the biography that I co-wrote with John Feaster, and this is what we had to say. Her grandfather's family were freed slaves. She held a PhD in English language and literature. She was an expert on William Faulkner and a gifted vocalist and speaker. Echoing across a Mississippi church, leading a school children's choir, or in a northern cathedral filled with people of all races across the United States in one parish or another, in New Orleans at the Institute for Black Catholic Studies, eventually on national television, or even later, stricken, as you mentioned, with cancer, leading We Shall Overcome in the halls of the U.S. Catholic bishops. She was written about in newspaper after newspaper, and all along the way, her voice and her presence were unforgettable. And that's Sister Thea Bowman, a sister both in the African-American soulful sense of the term and also a sister in the more formal vowed sense of the Roman Catholic community. She was a black sister. She was a Catholic Franciscan sister, one who, as a teen, moved 1,000 miles from home outside her culture, yet developed a deep sense of her cultural identity nonetheless. As she discovered her identity, the identity of a beautiful black Mississippi woman, she couldn't contain it, and the people around her couldn't help but notice. In the years after the peak of the civil rights movement in the 1960s and especially in the 1980s, as the nation grappled with the questions of racial identity and equality, hers became a mesmerizing presence wherever she went. Singing the songs of her African-American people with operatic skill, she worked with people of all races to help them to see their own lives in a new light. Through music and reflections, she helped people everywhere she went to explore their identity and to find their deeper humanity. It is one of life's mysteries that a life so engaging, so promising, could fall to a terminal illness midlife. Yet that's a key part of Thea's story, one of a black childhood in a majority black region, of a formative adulthood in an all-white setting far north of her home, then of a growing national reputation as a beacon of intercultural awareness. It's a story of a person who ultimately said, "Let me live until I die."
Yeah, I love that.
She said that very, very often. And she showed those people around her how to drink deeply of life's promise to the very end, even as she spent her final years struggling against cancer. So that's our Thea. You know, when your colleague, Harry Cosgrove, talked to me about your program, I asked him whether or not he knew Sister Thea, and he said no, but he saw the 60 Minutes segment featuring
yes.
Thea that was aired in 1987, and he thought she was a very intriguing woman. And that's what Mike Wallace said, too. Mike Wallace said when he was writing about her, "I don't remember when I've seen when I've been more moved, more enchanted by a person whom I profiled than by Sister Thea Bowman. You simply couldn't come away from a session with Thea without sharing the special sense of joy she seemed to bring to everything she turned her hand to." And Thea told him, "I think one difference between me and some other people is that I'm content to do my little bit. Sometimes people think that they have to do big things in order to make change. But if each one of us would light a candle, we would have a tremendous light." And I think that Thea remained true to those words. She crowded a lot of little bits into her 52 mm-hmm. years. Actually, she transcended, much of what she did transcended the adjective little. She made decisions and faced situations that required a great deal of courage and influenced thousands. Part of her little bit philosophy was to try.
Yeah.
Before she died in 1990, she said she wanted engraved on her tombstone, "She tried, and it was."
You know, Sister, I never saw any of the documentaries on her or the TV interviews or anything about her. But when I heard the name Thea Bowman, mm-hmm. I can't explain what happened within me, deep, deep within me, in the deepest recesses of my heart. I felt as if I knew her. Her name rang so true in me. And then when I started to, peruse the book, when I came into the studio, even that she's gone, living eternally now, she's made her presence very much in my own heart as I began to read, especially the part about trying. Let it be said that I tried. I just talked the other day about that on the radio. If we try to make changes in our lives slowly but surely, that impact will get larger and larger all the time, not only in our lives, but in the lives of others. And here's a woman that absolutely did that day in and day out.
You're absolutely correct.
Let me ask you something. Mm-hmm. I thought it was so cute. Is this true that she was the only, at that time that she became, took her vows, that she was the only black member of her community?
That's right, and she's the only black sister we've ever had in our community.
Isn't it amazing, sister?
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
What,
yeah.
One soul,
you know,
and the impact.
People who know me often hear me say that I think I'm a very fortunate person, and one of the main reasons I say that is that for 35 years, my life was kind of in orbit around Thea, and now she's been dead 20-plus years, and 2 years ago, on the anniversary of her death, March 30th, I had the privilege of going to Memphis, Tennessee, where she's buried, and every year since she's died, they have had a mass at her gravesite, and it's a Redemptorist priest, Father Maurice Nutt, who was her student, one of her students at the Institute of Black Catholic Studies, is the celebrant at the liturgy. And when we were there, it was a beautiful, sunshiny spring day in Memphis, and there were about 100 of us at her gravesite. And it's kind of on an incline, very close to one of the main roads. And there were about 75 students from one of the elementary schools who sang with us. And after we had the introduction and the readings and the gospel and the homily, we walked further up the hill to a large rock, which was a marker for the graves, the unmarked graves of 300 slaves. And there we had the rest of the mass, the offertory and the communion. It was an absolutely amazing experience. And I thought to myself, how many people do I know who have masses celebrated at their grave sites? I just couldn't believe that it was taking place, and it takes place every year. And I was just amazed at that.
You know, as you shared, first off, this book is so beautifully written.
Thank you.
You can sense that you not only knew Thea and was she part of your congregation, which is the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration, but beyond that, you can see that even today, as you say, 20 years after she's entered into eternal life, her life, as you knew it, is still impacting your own life.
It certainly is. And, you know, you said before, she seems very alive to you, too.
Yes.
And I have noticed these last 20 years that in many cases, Thea is more alive to people who never knew her, which I think is amazing. That's the power of her spirit. She's often over my left shoulder laughing.
Aww.
So we have a good time. Now, I'll go back. You know that she was born in December in 1937, and she was born in Yazoo City. Her father was a doctor working in Canton, which is about 30 miles from Yazoo City, but it didn't have a hospital for black people, so they wanted their daughter to be born in a hospital. Her mother, Mary Esther, was older at the time, 35 years. In 1937, that was considered old.
Yes.
To have a first child. But they went over there, and Thea actually was born before the doctor got to the house and to take her to the hospital. And Thea's own father got there before the other doctor got there. And Thea got such a kick out of that, she would often crow about saving her dad $25 having to go to the hospital. And she was named Bertha, a name that she did not like, but she had a nickname, Birdie.
Yeah.
Like that, because she had a fondness for birds. She was amazing. She was an only child. She was precocious. She was musical. She learned a lot from her elders. She called them her old folks. And from the early age, she had a very spiritual bent. She talked about going to all the churches in Canton. She said that she was a church hopper. She said she and her friends got a lot of joy out of watching the older people sing and dance at church. And then, when she was 9 years old, something wonderful happened. She said Catholics came to her town. Some missionaries from Alabama came to start a church. And there's a photograph of the church in the book, and it was an old army barracks. But Thea went to that, too, and she was fascinated. She said she got a kick out of people praying in a different language, and she liked the smell of incense, and she was very taken with the Catholics and with those priests and a couple of sisters who were social workers there at the time, too. And she decided to get herself baptized. So without telling her parents, she did just that at age 9.
Amazing.
I think it's amazing. But she grew up in the Jim Crow South, and she went to public school for 6 years. And her mother was a teacher and a singer, her father a doctor, as I said. And by the time she was in the fifth and sixth grade, her parents were alarmed that she wasn't learning anything. The public schools in Canton that the blacks had to attend were ill-equipped. So in 1949, our community, the Franciscan Sisters from La Crosse, Wisconsin, started a mission school. And they went around and they invited all of the blacks to come to their school. And for Thea, this was absolutely wonderful because they had decent books. They had teachers who really cared about them. She said that she went through the Think and Do books, I think from grades 1 to 8, like a flash. She was very bright, of course.
Yes.
And so then, after 4 years of being in the presence of these loving, caring, wonderful white women, and these were the first white people that she ever really knew, but after 4 years of that, she announced to her parents that she was going to enter the convent. Well, they were alarmed. They didn't want to have their only child go to the convent.
I guess.
You know, they were looking forward to grandchildren, as parents naturally do. But she was adamant, and when they wouldn't give her permission, she started to fast. She wouldn't eat anything. So her parents were alarmed at that, and they finally gave permission. But her father said to her, you know, you really ought to go to a community in the South. How about the black community in New Orleans? Why don't you go there? And she said, no, I want to go to the Franciscans in Wisconsin. And her father said, they're not going to like you up there. And she said, I'll make them like me.
Oh.
And, of course, she did. So that was in the 1950s, and that's when I first met her. And you alluded to the fact that the first time I ever met her.
I think that's a riot.
I think it is, too. It was the first day I was at the convent, and we got to the evening meal, and there was this black girl doing the spiritual reading. In those days, as some people know, we used to have the practice of listening to some spiritual reading while we ate. And as I said, I just thought, well, that's very interesting that the nuns are having black people doing their reading. But right after the meal, I found out who she was, and I found out that the sisters did not have servants doing their reading. And so we became fast friends. We both wanted to be teachers, and we both wanted to major in English and minor in theater. And so when it was time to go to college, we were in many of the same classes. She helped me to change my perspective from being a provincial person to being a much more universal person.
Praise God.
Just think I was incredibly lucky to know her as well as I did. So that all went along, and then you've gone through the book, and you know that before she made her first vows, she got tuberculosis.
Yeah.
You know, she entered this white world in Wisconsin where it was cold and snowy and so different from her own culture. She got tuberculosis, and she had to go to a sanitarium for almost a whole year before she was cured of that. And she used to talk about how she was confined to bed rest, and that just about killed her because she was a very lively person. But she finally recovered, and she came back, and she made first profession of vows in 1958. And then, as was the custom, she began to teach, and I also began to teach. She taught at a local school here in La Crosse, Blessed Sacrament School, and it was sort of an upper middle class white school. And the first thing she did was to begin to build a bridge between where she had gone to school in Canton, Mississippi, Holy Child Jesus School, and her students at Blessed Sacrament. They wrote letters back and forth, and they learned a lot about each other's culture, and it was a really good experience. And today, some of those students are still around, and they're professionals here in La Crosse, doctors and lawyers and business people. And they remember Thea as their favorite teacher of all time.
Hmm.
I think it's interesting, too.
Yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, talk about a teaching moment for all of us, actually, that she had the foresight and the being a visionary to see that as she brought these two cultures together, that both cultures could benefit by it. And she carried that theme on through her whole life, didn't she, in the church?
She certainly did. That was her mission. She wanted to share her own identity and build a Black Catholic identity, and then that to her was the ultimate Christian identity. And she spent her adult life bridging between all the cultures.
Mm-hmm. As I perused the book and read particularly the last chapters of her life, mm-hmm. She had a quote, and I believe it was a quote anyway. It said, in it, she was talking about suffering, and she said, "I don't make sense of suffering. I try to make sense of life." And I thought, how profound that was. Simple,
mm-hmm.
In its simplicity, it was profound.
I think that's why she was able to reach so many people. She was able to say profound things in a very simple manner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, then, in 1961, she got to go back to her hometown, and she taught high school there. And she said that was the hardest teaching job she ever had. She was kind of upset that not all the students liked learning as much as she did. But they had a common interest, and that was music. And so through their music, they got along just fine. Then in the 1960s, she started to go to graduate school at Catholic University, and for two summers she went there and she taught during the academic year. And then she was released and became a full-time graduate student at Catholic University and got her master's degree and her PhD in English language and literature. She had a ball in Washington, D.C., because this is the first time in her life that she met Black people, other than her own father and mother, who were professionals. She met Black people, young Black people, who were professionals working in the government, teaching at the university, the clergy and sisters. And this opened her eyes to what could be, and so she really, really blossomed. She studied a lot of literature, and she did a paper on oral literature in the Black culture, and she presented it, I think, to a class first, and it was very popular. Of course, she sang a little bit with it, too. And then she presented it to a larger group at Catholic University, and then word got around how good it was, and so then she went to Howard University, and then she went to a couple of the other colleges on the East Coast, and gradually she became known as an outstanding presenter and teacher and singer and all of those good things.
Mm.
So then, for her graduation gift, getting a PhD, her parents gave her a trip to Europe. And that was an eye-opener for her, too. It was the first time she'd been out of the country. And she fell in love with the people in Germany. She couldn't get over how energetic and joyful and smart and flexible they were, because she had associated with a whole lot of Germans in our own Franciscan community who she thought were a little bit more rigid than the ones that she met in Germany. So she was happy to have that experience. She loved France because she studied French and she could speak the language. She got to Italy, and it was nice and warm, finally, and that was wonderful. And she went to, of course, all the spiritual sites in Rome and Florence. And then finally, where every Franciscan loves to go, she got to go to Assisi.
Oh, me too. I love it.
Yeah, it is really wonderful. And one of Thea's main characteristics was her joy, and she really honed in on the joy that she found in Francis, and she let everybody know that's what Franciscans are, they're joyful people. And then, before she came back to the United States, she went to England, where she was taking a 3 or 4 week course at Oxford University. She was studying the novels of Jane Austen and a few other things, but she was intensely interested in going to all the places, birthplaces and homes of a lot of the great literary professionals that she had studied either in world literature or in American literature, English literature. They also went to Greece, and that was wonderful for her, too. And I can just see her, you know, taking mental notes everywhere she went. Well, I'll tell the students in my class about this, or I'll tell them about that. And it was really a great experience for her. So then, after Europe, she was assigned to teach at our college, Viterbo College. It's a university now. She was there for 6 years, and she was probably most popular teacher on campus. She was constantly invited to speak at all kinds of events and sing also. And I was dean of students at that time, and when I came to the campus, I was warned, beware of Sister Thea. She's the most powerful woman on campus. And I just had to smile because we were friends and I wasn't worried about any kind of bad relations with her at all. Students loved her because she took them on trips. She took them to the South and she introduced them to Southern writers like William Faulkner and Eudora Welty and a lot of the people from New Orleans. And she always saw to it that the students were housed in homes of locals so that they could mix with the local people. And the students absolutely loved that. And then some of the students from the South came up to the North, and they stayed in each other's homes, and that was quite wonderful, too. They talked about their Southern mothers and their Northern mothers. Hmm. And it was just a lasting experience for them. Then, in 1978, she was realizing that her parents were aging and their health was deteriorating, especially her mother, so she got to go back to Mississippi. And I went to Washington, D.C. On a sabbatical and stayed there for 15 years doing various administrative and consulting ministries. And when she went back to Mississippi, she went immediately to the bishop and asked whether or not there was something that she could do for the Diocese of Jackson, and Bishop Brunini, whom she loved, was delighted to have her there because he knew about her power. And so he gave her a position, and she became the Director of Intercultural Awareness. And that let her go to all kinds of parishes in Mississippi, and wherever she went, she would gather up the school children or gather up singers, and she would teach what she wanted to do and also sing. And so she was a hit, and she became a very, very popular presenter. So that went on for a while, and then she became more and more well-known in the South, Alabama, Georgia, and always back up to Washington, D.C., and back up to Wisconsin. And every time she would come to Washington, D.C., she would call me up, and she'd say, I'm going to be speaking at such and such a place at such and such a time. I hope you can come, and I'm hungry. And I would say to her, what do you want? Chinese, Italian, Mexican, pizza? And she'd say, all of them. She
My kind
so
of girl.
She needed food.
Sister,
I remember one time in Washington, she was giving a presentation, and we were invited to dinner, and we were in the lounge of one of the big hotels there, and a piano player was playing songs from Porgy and Bess.
Mm-hmm.
And she stood up, and she went over to the piano, and she began to sing. And I looked around and I said, I have no idea who that woman is. And then she got a standing ovation. And I said, oh, yeah, that's my friend, Sister Thea Bowman. She sang again. But she would do spontaneous things like that, and people fell in love with her spontaneity. It was just quite a wonderful thing.
So endearing, you know. We're going to take a little break.
Okay.
Once again, if you'd sister is very kind. She offered to our audience today, if you'd like to ask a question to her about Thea's song, that's the name of the book that was written. It's all about the life of Thea Bowman, Sister Thea Bowman. And they were both sisters, Franciscan sisters of Perpetual Adoration. And not only that, they were best friends and shared the gift of life with each other. And you can really see that in this beautifully written book. So my brothers and sisters, if you have a question you'd like to ask Sister Charlene Smith, please give a call, 610-527-2906. 610-527-2906. This has gone out globally, and if you'd like to call outside the area code, dial 1-888-343-2484. Once again, toll free 1-888-343-2484. Don't go away. We have a lot more to talk about this beautiful gift to the world, Sister Thea Bowman. And again, I can only tell you one of her quotes that I love is, "I want to live." And today we have the privilege of speaking to Sister Charlene Smith, who co-wrote a book with John Feister, and it's called Thea's Song. And I encourage you to get this book and read it. It is beautifully written, and not only that, if you never heard of this young woman, I'm going to tell you, she will inspire you, she'll set your heart on fire, and you'll fall in love with her. First off, she was a brilliant young woman, and she made such an impact with the joy that emanated out of her into the lives of all those who knew her and met her, or like myself, just fell in love with her as I read the book. So with us, we're going to go back again. I'm talking to Sister Charlene Smith. She was a sister in the convent with Sister Thea, and also they were sisters in Christ as friends. So welcome once again, Sister Charlene Smith.
Thank you, Kathleen. I think I'll move on to 1984, which was probably the most challenging year of Thea's life. That was the year that she was diagnosed with breast cancer.
Yes.
In March. That was the year also that her parents' health deteriorated. Because of cancer, she had to go through rounds of chemotherapy and radiation and lost her hair and all of that kind of stuff and was put on a real strict diet. And for somebody who loved to eat as much as she did, loved ice cream and all of those things, she never complained. She ate exactly what she was supposed to eat. At the end of the year, in November, her mother died. In December, her father also passed away. She was kind of fragile at that time, and her friends thought it would be a nice gesture if they would send her to Africa to the International Eucharistic Conference Congress that was going to be held in Kenya. She was delighted to go. She met people from all the continents, and she loved the mix of various cultures, and the liturgies were wonderful, and she was able to meet all kinds of new people, especially from Africa. She fell in love with Africa, and after the Eucharistic Congress, she got to go up to Nigeria. She really loved the people there. She knew one of the sisters from one of the African communities there and actually stayed in their home. And every time that she was in Africa, wherever she was, she said that she felt so totally at home. She thought she was from Nigeria. She thought her parents, or not her parents, but her ancestors were from Nigeria. She never found that out for sure, but she felt a real affinity for that place. So that trip to Africa was really a major gift for her, and it did buoy up her spirits, even though her spirits were mostly naturally high. Then it followed after that CBS got in touch with Thea. They'd heard about her, and it took 2 years filming various segments. And finally, Mike Wallace did a segment on Thea, and it was produced in May of 1987. Thea didn't tell me that it was going to be televised on that particular evening, and I was in Washington, and people started to call me wanting to know, is that your Thea? I said, yeah, that's my Thea. And I tried to call Thea, but her phone was busy almost till midnight. I finally gave up. But that television program really inspired people all over the United States about the life of this wonderful, wonderful woman. And then in 1988, she was continuing her speaking tour, and in January of 1988, she was giving a talk at Milwaukee for Martin Luther King's birthday celebration, one of the really outstanding talks that she did. And there was a large Milwaukee adult choir there, and she was conducting it, and she was acting like a Stravinsky almost in it. She gave a marvelous presentation about Martin Luther King, whom she really, really admired. But after that talk in January of 1988, something shocking happened when she got back to Canton, Mississippi. She was in terrible acute pain, and the doctors told her that her cancer had metastasized to the spine and to her bones. And that January talk in Milwaukee was the last time she was able to deliver a presentation standing up.
Mm.
That's why you see her in lots of photographs in a wheelchair.
In a wheelchair, yeah.
And when Dan Rooney, who is the owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, found out that Thea needed a wheelchair, he presented her with one. You might wonder how Thea got to know Dan Rooney, the football guy.
I know him.
It turned out that the year that Dan Rooney was given the most prestigious award from Viterbo College, the John the 23rd Award, we call it, Thea also received an award. And whoever gets an award has to give a little talk. Dan Rooney did his, and then Thea did hers. She had the three lobbies, three levels of the lobby, filled with singers. And Dan Rooney never forgot that. And he remained her friend. And so with that wheelchair, Thea got a kick out of it, and she called it her Steeler Mobile. And that was the year also, 1988, that she had her portrait painted. Two of her childhood friends, two Canton friends who knew her when she was a child, commissioned Marsha Bolden, who's a very famous portrait painter, to do a portrait of Thea. And I talked to Marsha Bolden, and he said that he thinks that the portrait that he did of Thea, which is ubiquitous, it's all over wherever she was because there are prints of it all over, but he said he thinks it's the best portrait, probably the best portrait that he has ever painted. And his portraits are hanging in the National Gallery in London and also in Washington, D.C. And Marsha Bolden told me that when he was asked to paint a portrait of a nun who was cancer-stricken, he thought, oh, my gosh, I got to go paint this old woman who's probably sick. But he got to her house and turned out that she was vibrant and alive. And she wore a beautiful African dress that she wore lots of places, and she would not put her turban on. She said, no, I want to be painted as I am, bald. Of course, my thought is she had a beautifully shaped head, so why not? But,
yeah.
But that portrait is really quite, quite beautiful.
And
there's a photograph of it in the book Thea's Song.
Yeah, I saw it. Beautiful. It hangs in the Diocese of Jackson, I believe.
That's right. It's in the chancery there. But there are prints of it all over the place. Maybe I'll send you one.
Please, I would love that. Like I said, something in my own spirit quickened, and I just felt an affinity with her. And I just could... I feel like I've met her or I've known her. You know, I just fell in love with her as I read this book, with her, yeah. Her zest for life, living life to the fullest as Jesus commanded, and that it affected everybody else's life that she met. That's amazing.
It just delights me that she affects you that way, too. She really does inspire people.
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, then after the 60 Minutes show, Harry Belafonte saw it. And he thought, well, that's an interesting woman. I think I'll do a movie about her. So he arranged a meeting with her I think the first meeting they had was out in Hollywood, Beverly Hills. And she thought that would be fine, and he wanted Whoopi Goldberg to play Thea. And everything was going along rather smoothly. They had a screenwriter doing some work on a possible script. And then Thea got sicker, and Harry Belafonte got involved with the Haitian issue. So that did not materialize. But I'm sure someday there will be a movie made of her. In the meantime, there are two marvelous videos of her. One is called Her Own Story, which is sort of a video autobiography of Thea. And on that, she sings and tells her story, and there are lots of people who are her friends in Mississippi especially, and some of the sisters too. And then the other video that they did before she died was one called Almost Home, and that's a story of living with a terminal illness, and every time I look at it, I don't like to look at that one very often because it makes me cry. It's very, very sad, but it's profound. Both of them are worth looking at. Well, then 1989, she went back to Africa in a wheelchair. Can you imagine?
Amazing, amazing.
But she couldn't wait to go back to Africa. She was invited there by the Marinol sisters, and she gave some workshops, and she had herself a really good time. And the people who went with her, Sister Dorothy Ann Kuninger, who was her companion the last several years of her life, went with her and a couple of the other sisters that she knew here in the United States. And they were amazed at how electric Thea became when she was presenting her workshops. And then, of course, when that was over, she was kind of exhausted. Mm. But she loved being around all the people. Then, in 1989, that was the last time that she ever appeared in La Crosse, Wisconsin. We did a humanities symposium in March. And I was the chairman of that, and everybody wanted Thea to speak, and so they said, would you arrange that? So I called her up, and I said, you don't have to say yes, but she was happy to come. And it was snowing and cold when she got here. I think we write that in the book, and she arrived on a Friday afternoon with Sister Dorothy Ann Kuninger, and she immediately got herself horizontal, and she stayed horizontal until Sunday night when they had a choir rehearsal. But all the while she was here, she entertained visitors. People began streaming into the convent from the college and our sisters and friends. And as soon as people heard that she was in town, they had to come to see Thea. And at that time, her bones were so hollow. They were like a beehive. And she wouldn't let me touch her except we linked our little fingers together, but that's as much as she would tolerate. I don't know how she put up with that. And I kept telling her, Thea, you don't have to do a presentation. We can figure out something else for the program. She said, don't worry, I'll be all right. So on the Monday morning, we took her over to the Fine Arts Center, where we have a big theater, and put her in the green room, and again, she went horizontal, and so we had the first part of the program, and she was the last speaker in the morning session, and I went in short before I was going to introduce her and said, you don't have to do this, but she said, I'm coming. So she got in her wheelchair, and they rolled her out onto the stage, and she just came alive, and they gave her a standing ovation, and it was absolutely electric. It was just one of the most profound presentation that she ever gave. She was delighted to be back with her people here in La Crosse. There were a lot of her students, and she told them the most important thing was to love one another, and that she did. That was a huge thing in 1989, and then in June, as you probably have read about or heard, she was invited to talk to the United States Catholic Bishops in Seton Hall, at Seton Hall University, and again, she was wheeled in her wheelchair, and she started her talk to the bishops by singing, Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child.
Wow.
And it just stunned all of the bishops. And she told them exactly what she thought. She said, now, I've done a lot of things your way. It's time for the Catholic Church to do some things our way.
Beautiful. And
it was a profound, just a profound experience. And
she shared what it was like to be Black and Catholic, and apparently it made such a profound impact on the bishops that that they sort of yielded to her request.
She's hard to resist, I must say. She's like a magnet. And you know, and at the end, she got them to stand up and sing We Shall Overcome, and she had them linking arms and swaying back and forth, We Shall Overcome. And her voice was spectacular that day. The recordings of that, you can see some of that on the video, her own story. It's just a spectacular rendition of We Shall Overcome. And she was singing the big high notes. And I know that at that time her right arm was so fragile she couldn't even raise it. She gestured the whole speech with her left hand. But when she had the bishops cross their arms and sing We Shall Overcome, she had two bishops beside her, and they were holding her hand. And I thought to myself, how could she possibly stand that pain that she must be? But she always said that when she sang or moaned, somehow the pain seemed to lessen.
Mm.
At any rate, when the thing was over, they presented her with roses, of course, and she dedicated them to all the mothers and grandmothers that prayed all those bishops to where they are right now. And then Tom Roberts, who's a reporter for the National Catholic, reporter for the National Catholic Reporter, went and stood in the hall where Thea was wheeled, and the bishops one by one came to her and asked her for her blessing, which I think is absolutely
amazing. Yes.
And I've spoken to several bishops who were there, and they still say that that was one of the most astonishing experiences and grace-filled experiences that they ever had.
Sister, can you, I would love to see one of those videos. Can you still somewhere get a hold of one of those?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you, I don't know if you have access to our website.
What is your website?
www.ssspa, Franciscan Sister Perpetual Adoration, FSPA.
Okay.
.org.
.org.
And go to the website, and then over on the left-hand side it says About Us.
Okay.
And then it moved to Sister Thea Bowman, and there's all kinds of information, all
Great.
Kinds of recent articles in it, all kinds of information about the videos.
Excellent.
They got 800 numbers, and they're out in DVD now, too. So
wonderful. I'd like to ask you a quick question. I've been involved in healing ministry for 40 years, and very much I just have a book and CDs out myself that have received an imprimatur under prophetic. And in this book, I see in the beginning, and it says, she sang, she taught, she told the old story, she prophesied, she inspired, she made us listen, she taught us to hear. And are they talking about the prophetic word issuing forth from her in as much as building up the kingdom, or more of a visionary type thing?
Oh, I think the prophetic word, she was a prophet.
No wonder I have such an affinity for her then.
Yeah. And that's a quotation, I think, from Cyprian Davis.
Exactly.
Who is a scholar and a theologian, and he knows what he's talking about. Yeah, she was into love, and I remember at the end of her life, one of the last talks that she was giving, maybe a year before she died, she was in Dubuque, and she called me up. I guess I called her up, and I said, what are you going to talk about this time, Thea? And she said, love. Oh, no, she said power. And I said, power, Thea, you're a humble Franciscan. You aren't supposed to be in the power game. And she said, so long a time have I been with you, Charlene, and you don't know that power equals love.
Amen.
I remember she would often say to me, and she would often say to many people, and she'd end her talks by saying, I love you. I love you. I really, really love you. And that's really the message that she leaves.
Well, I'm blessed to have you with us today. You sound like, shall I say, you're a woman after Thea's own heart. Theo actually means of God, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And her father's name was Theon, T-H-E-O-N. Mm-hmm. So they kind of think that she took that name because she wanted to pay tribute to her father, who she loved.
Yeah.
It's true or not. It's something we never really discussed.
Well, sister, would you be so kind and... I would love to get a print of that if you'd be so kind.
Sure.
And love to catch up with you someday and be in touch with you. And also, would you be so kind to close the program with a prayer? Maybe the prayer of the joy and the love that we're all called to share.
Well, Thea would say... Sometimes people think that they have to do big things in order to make change, but if each one of us would light a candle, we'd have a tremendous light. Her signature song was, "This Little Light of Mine, I'm going to Let It Shine." Thea discovered the light within herself, and she also taught other people to find the light within themselves. I feel very graced to have known her. I think everybody who does know her, who did know her, who is going to know her through the books and videos and possible movie and all the articles and all the art, will fall in love with her too.
Mm. I wouldn't be surprised if you hear little subtle innuendos maybe about her becoming venerable and blessed and maybe eventually a saint.
The African-American Catholic community has proclaimed her a saint by acclamation.
Well,
you realize, I don't know how much time we have, but
about 1996,
we had a big conference call with lots of friends of Thea, clergy, bishops, sisters, to find out whether or not there was a need to start a canonization process. And while everybody insists that she's holy and she is a saint, it was decided that Thea would not want the money that you'd spend on canonization to go to that. She would rather have the money go to education.
Mm.
So that's where we are right now.
Well,
I'm sure eventually she'll be declared.
I would imagine.
But they say the first miracle is when she made the bishops dance.
I was thinking that myself. One of those bishops that were there might be the postulator himself. Well, sister... God bless you, and God bless you for your yes to build up the kingdom of God and following your call to be a religious. May God bless you and continue the good work.
Thank you so much for having us.
Bye, dear.
Bye, and God bless.
Well, my brothers and sisters, that we all may have that song in each of our hearts. Thea sang, she taught. We should sing the song that God places in each of our heart. And we should teach everybody that we come in contact with that God loves each and every one of us, as St. Augustine said, as if there were only one of us to love. There might be just one Thea Bowman, but there is only one of you. And if you try, and I try, we can make a tremendous difference in the world. My brothers and sisters, remember, if you're away from the church, come on home. She's not complete without you. And if you're away from the sacraments, talk about healing. Come on home and receive that healing balm of Gilead through the sacramental gift of the church and confession. And then be fed and nourished with Christ's life. Let us take that life, the life of Christ, out into the world that we can all be Christ givers. God bless you.